is there perhaps something more than what I see, maybe more than rationality, maybe more than naturalism? And so that led me to thinking, okay, maybe I should think that there is possibility of a supernatural. And at that point, I kind of went from atheist to agnostic. And I wouldn't say, you know, definitely would not say I was a Christian, did not want to explore Christianity at that point in time. But at least at that point in time, I would have put it this way, that I'm open to some existence beyond the natural, whether that's God, gods, goddesses, God, you know, whatever, I'm open to it. And maybe I should go look into these things.
Hello, and thanks for joining in. I'm Jana Harmon, and you're listening to Side B Stories, where we see how skeptics flip the record of their lives. Each podcast, we listen to someone who was once an atheist or skeptic, but who surprisingly became a Christian. You can also hear this podcast and more stories like these on our website at www.sidebstories.com. It's often believed by atheists that science is the sole source of knowledge, and that science points to a godless reality. There is no need to impose a God explanation any longer, they think. We are beyond that, more sophisticated than that. Science has or will have all of the answers eventually. It is acknowledged by both secular thinkers and Christians that science does provide knowledge of how and when material universe acts and reacts, causes and effects, and that much can be known through the scientific method. That is not in dispute. But what happens when scientific observations actually point towards the need for an explanation outside of the material universe in order to understand and explain what we see of the universe itself? What happens when investigating science causes someone to question their own secular understanding of reality? That which we observe and measure needs a greater explanation than the material world itself. But within atheism, or naturalism, the closed universe of cause and effect is all there is, was, or ever will be. We are pieces in the clockwork of the natural universe, winding down to an inevitable, encroaching end, with nothing to explain our intuitions that there must be something more to explain our own lives and our own experiences. Today's guest, MIT graduate Chris Lee, has a brilliant mind. His inquisitive mind led him to ask questions which were too pressing to ignore. He's going to take us on his journey of searching and finding answers. Welcome to the Side B Stories podcast, Chris. It's so great to have you with me today.
Thank you, Jana, for having me.
Wonderful. Before we get into your story, why don't you tell me a little bit about who you are, where you live, maybe a little bit about your education, what you do?
Sure, absolutely. I live in the Boston area in a little town called Braintree, about 10 miles south of the downtown. By day, I consider myself a software engineer in financial services, so fintech. And by night, I jokingly say that I'm a cult fighter. I graduated from MIT in 1997 and also did my master's degree in divinity at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary.
Okay. So you're pretty highly educated. And of course, in the Boston area, academics is prevalent there. So I'm sure we'll find out more about what you mean by cult fighter.
something like that.
Something like that. I forgot the exact term. But anyway, so let's, that sounds very intriguing. I'm sure we'll get to that later in the podcast. So you're in Boston now. Tell me about, let's go back to your childhood and where you were born and grew up. And tell me a little bit about your family, whether they had any belief in God or not, or how they directed you.
Sure. I grew up in Western Canada in a city called Vancouver. Beautiful, amazing place to grow up, very multicultural. And my parents, my dad was very much an atheist, a humanist, so did not have any beliefs, and in fact had been very hurt by a number of Christians in his life. So he had very much turned against Christianity and was, as you know, you might expect, anti-Christian. My mother was very nominal. She might have gone to church a few times now and then in college as well as afterwards. And certainly she had a belief in a higher power. She believed in God. She prayed, but it was not very evident in her life. And certainly if she mentioned that she was Christian, it was only a name, as I mentioned, the very nominal side. So that's the background.
So Vancouver, is that, tell me, culturally speaking, is that much of a religious community or is it?
No, not at all. Okay. I would say probably like less than 20% even identify as Christians. Certainly it's very small. It's maybe more than New England where I am, which is like something like 5% or less evangelical and something like very nominally Roman Catholic. But certainly religion in Western Canada was not a public thing and was not even a major factor in people's lives.
So did you have any exposure to what you would consider a more robust form of Christianity growing up? Any people that you knew, or was that in your world at all?
Sure. So there's kind of two major influences. My grandmother was very devout, but we didn't have a lot of exposure to her. And then my best friend in high school was able to answer a lot of my questions, and he was and continues to be a very devout Christian today. And so whenever I had weird questions like, I don't understand the Bible, or I don't understand this Trinity thing, this is weird, I would go to my best friend in high school, Vern, and we talk about it. And he very cogently explained to me these doctrines.
Okay, so you did have some influences. So as you were growing up, you had a father, you said, who was a secular humanist. He was an atheist. You had a mother who was a bit of a nominal, had a nominal expression of faith. So when you were growing up, did you have any belief in God? Were you following in the footsteps of your father or your mother? Or was it an issue or something? Did you go to church? Talk with me about that.
Sure. We were taken, so my younger brother and I were taken to church for a while, maybe off and on, whenever we weren't on vacations or whenever it was, you know, kind of convenient. So maybe a couple times a month, and mostly to go to the, you know, Sunday school programs and socializing. And I really didn't get all much of the faith, and a lot of it seems like rituals. So I really didn't understand why people did what they did. And then when I was 12, my dad came up to me and said, well, you know, Chris, you're 12, you're old enough to make your own decisions. If this is what you want to do, then, you know, you have my whatever equivalent of blessing, I guess you can do it. But if you don't want to do it, then, you know, stop doing it. And then I said to him at that time, yeah, I don't understand this. So, you know, it makes no sense. I'm going to stop doing it. And also around the same point in time, we were talking about college applications already at, you know, age 12 and, you know, preparing for higher education. And also I had become very enamored of science. And, you know, I kind of like Carl Sagan puts it, that the cosmos is all that is and all that ever was and all that ever would be. And really believed that science could or would be able to explain everything. And so I said, well, this, you know, all seems like superstitious hogwash, every kind of religion, especially going to church and things like that. So I, at that point in time, decided I'm going to be an atheist. And it was a distinct moment in my life that I remember. It was over 2 years where I said, you know, I don't believe any religion is true. I reject it all. You know, all this stuff seems like either fantasy or hogwash. Your choice.
So when you rejected God and that metaphysical reality, any kind of supernatural reality, you by default, in a sense, you embraced a naturalistic view of the world.
Correct.
Did you think, I know you said you really honored or revered science in a way as being an ultimate explainer, in a sense, of the world, and that there was not anything more than that. Would you say that you looked at the naturalistic worldview with any kind of critical eye at all in terms of the logical implications of that naturalistic worldview? Or were you looking more at just the positive aspects of, you know, intellectual people believe in science, not in hogwash? What was your line of thinking around that time?
That's a great question. So yes, absolutely. I actually carried through a number of the logical conclusions. So in fact, we were being taught, you know, not only evolution and all that it entails, but you can apply that also, you know, the Darwinian evolution to, you know, the survival of the fittest. And certainly, in terms of implications, if I'm smarter than, you know, somebody else, I deserve to live longer, or, you know, deserve to have my opinions heard more rightly than other people. I became very elitist in a way. I'm kind of ashamed now to admit it, but certainly kind of had this air of superiority because I thought that, you know, my thinking was correct, more correct than others. And certainly that those who were more correct deserved to have their voices heard, and, you know, the less correct voices did not deserve to have their voices heard. So certainly I did carry through in some of those implications of what I believed. I didn't fully see like that, you know, certainly naturalism and humanism have certain assumptions, like, you know, as you alluded to, the, you know, if you basically eliminate all, you know, possibility of the supernatural, that, you know, it's almost like, okay, everything has to be explained by science, or, you know, it's kind of like you're almost using science in a way of being like God in the gaps, instead of, you know, using, you know, God is the God of the gaps or things like that kind of argument.
Yeah, that tells me a little bit about you, that you are obviously a critical thinker, that you were willing to look a little bit more closely at what you were embracing, not just what you were rejecting. Mm-hmm. So you were obviously a student, a teenager, you had embraced this atheistic identity, you were moving towards university and developing an elitist, intellectualist way of thinking, I guess, to pursue your goals of academia, mm-hmm, and achievement. So I wonder, were most of your friends thinking in the same kind of way? Did you have a lot of friends who called themselves or identified as atheists as well?
I had some friends who were atheists, maybe one or two, and then the rest of them were largely agnostics, true agnostics, meaning like they didn't know, you know, so in my mind, there's a major difference. Atheists are, you know, within reason, you've determined that there are no supernatural, there is no existence other than what we know, there is no possibility of any God or gods. And agnostics can range from, well, I'm not sure, and I'm not 100% certain that my position is correct, or you know, it doesn't have to be 100% certainty that, you know, there are no gods, but, you know, maybe even like 97% sure that, as in, that would be an atheist position. And then some agnostics were like, well, I haven't thought through it enough, so I don't know what to believe.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me as you were talking about the embracing of your naturalistic worldview, that there was a somewhat of a Darwinian perspective on, mm-hmm, who was perhaps the stronger or the more fit. And I think that oftentimes there is a dismissal of the religious in that kind of scenario and almost a contemptuousness. Did you ever have a sense of that as just a part of your atheistic worldview?
I didn't get to the point where I saw all, you know, whether it's Christianity or other religions as lacking zero credibility and zero value. I think I was much more pragmatist about it and very utilitarian. It's like, okay, well, you know, I guess some Christians do function as counselors and they give, you know, free counseling and help out the homeless. And okay, yeah, that's somewhat useful. And I definitely heard a number of my brother's sentiments, whether that's, you know, Freud expressing that Christianity is just, you know, a crutch for those who are mentally weak or other sentiments that are similar.
I'd like to pause for a moment and tell you about our new Side B Stories website. Perhaps you or someone you know is questioning whether or not belief in God is even possible or credible, whether or not Christianity is worthy of belief. The trouble is, in our culture today, Christianity is viewed largely as a belief system for the weak, delusional, and uneducated. It can be extremely difficult to break through the negativity and stereotypes to explore authentic, historic Christianity. If you're a skeptic or atheist, what would it take for you to consider the reality of God or the truth of Christianity? Or if you're a Christian, how can you better understand or engage with skeptics in a meaningful way? Our new Side B Stories website was created with you in mind. In addition to housing our podcast stories, it also features short video testimonies from former atheists and resources they have recommended or written about their own journeys to belief. And you'll hear their advice to skeptics on how to pursue a search for God and advice to Christians on how to engage with those who don't believe. We offer these stories from former skeptics on the Side B Stories website because there is no bigger question that affects your life than whether or not God is real or true, good or relevant. In a culture where Christianity is sometimes viewed unworthy of belief, Side B Stories shows what it did and does take for skeptics to become believers. You can find all of this by going to our new website, sidebstories.com. We hope you'll take a look and share this wonderful resource with skeptics and Christians alike. Now back to our story. So you lived with this perspective for a little while you were in high school. And so take us on your journey from there. How long were you in this atheistic perspective? What if anything kind of started making you question perhaps your own perspective and becoming open towards another?
Sure. So I would say it was just over 2 years, maybe somewhere between 2 and 2.5 years that I was very much, you know, would self-identify as an atheist and would tell you, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in anything. I believe science can explain everything or will explain everything. And I think even I had an atheist high school teacher who questioned that a little bit. And he said, well, wait a second, you know, are you sure that science will be able to explain everything? And I was like, wait, you're an atheist. Aren't you supposed to accept that science will or can explain everything? But it was really a set of three circumstances that really made me think that maybe atheism is not correct, or maybe that there is an existence outside of what we know, outside of a naturalistic environment. So the first thing was I was walking home. This was in, I think, the end of seventh grade or eighth grade or something like that. And I was walking home from my school. And on the way home, there's one side of the road that has a sidewalk and the other side has no sidewalk. And the other side that doesn't have a sidewalk is actually further. And for whatever reason, I decided I'm going to cross the sidewalk. And a car came over, kind of barreling out of control on the side of the sidewalk where I was standing. And I thought to myself, well, that's really strange. It's completely illogical and irrational to cross the street where it would be a further path and it's not got a sidewalk. And crossing the street, I could have been hit by a car, but and does this make sense? And it's like, I wouldn't have seen the car coming from behind me either that did eventually run over that piece of sidewalk. So, that was a little puzzling. And, you know, I didn't think anything much more when that happened.
Like it was a near miss?
Yeah, it was a near miss. Well, you know, that was an unusual piece of intuition that, you know, I crossed the street and, you know, should have been dead and am alive.
Okay.
And there's no rational reason for this. So, okay, whatever. And then the second time my mother was driving my brother and I back from whatever it was, I think from high school, and she had just finished the night shift, so she was really tired. And she forgot to stop at a stop sign, and the car kind of came over the hill and broadsided us. And it was on my side of the car, but 5 seconds before the accident happened, I actually unbuckled myself and moved over to the center of the car. Not seeing the car, I just unbuckled myself and moved. And again, I was like, my goodness, you know, I survived another crash and, you know, could have been seriously hurt. My mother actually did have whiplash and concussion, and she had to wear a neck brace for many months afterwards. So whereas I didn't have any injuries whatsoever, and it was very remarkable. So again, it was kind of like, what, you know, I should have been fully, you know, seatbelted and not taking it off at any point in time, but for whatever reason I moved. And then a third time, we were passing in between two warehouse buildings and there was a railway crossing, and the there was actually a train coming our way, but the gate had not dropped and there was no signal, and we barely missed it. It was like, I don't know, 6 feet, 10 feet. It couldn't have been more than that. And so there are a series of situations that I realized, like, well, probabilistically, I should be dead. And if I had followed everything rationally, done everything rationally, stayed on the same side of the sidewalk where eventually the car would have run over, kept my seatbelt on, that I should be dead. And yet here I am alive and all these things not very rational.
Right.
So is there perhaps something more than what I see, maybe more than rationality, maybe more than naturalism? And so that led me to thinking, okay, maybe I should think that there is possibility of a supernatural. And at that point, I kind of went from atheist to agnostic. And I wouldn't say, you know, definitely would not say I was a Christian, did not want to explore Christianity at that point in time. But at least at that point in time, I would have put it this way, that I'm open to some existence beyond the natural.
Okay.
Whether that's God, gods, goddesses, God, you know, whatever, I'm open to it. And maybe I should go look into these things. So this was at the age of 14.
Okay. So then you started looking, I presume. And tell me about that journey. Where did you go first? What did you start looking at first?
So I was very interested in pantheism. So I started exploring like Greco-Roman gods and explored, you know, that to its logical conclusion. It was like, okay, you know, maybe more gods is better and having a god for everything. So I had already studied Egyptian mythology, Norse mythology, Greco-Roman gods, even Hindu gods. And it seems like to me that if there were such god or goddesses, they were very haphazard, like, you know, throwing dice with our lives. And, you know, for the Egyptians, it was like there's a god for everything. There's a god of the Nile. There's a god of the dead. There's a god of fertility. There's a god of the rain. There's a god of the sun. You know, and so on and so forth. And certainly, I think as I've read, you know, kind of in retrospect as a Christian now, is when we use the word universe, it's like one out of many. And, you know, we're trying to make sense of like the diversity of life and the diversity of, you know, whether it's beetles or whether it's life forms or, you know, numerous other things. And I think the pantheism appeals to the diversity trying to explain that, but it didn't do a good job of trying to unify, you know, why does science make sense? Why is physics so mathematical and so elegant and so beautiful? You know, couldn't the pantheism doesn't unite very well there. And so I slowly, you know, rejected polytheism or pantheism. I moved into human wisdom religions. So Taoism, Buddhism, actually practiced, you know, a number of things like, you know, I feel hungry. No, I don't, because this is, you know, causing me to be imbalanced and I should not have, you know, strong desires because that's what causes conflict. And so I practiced a number of these things, and I realized, you know, later, especially becoming Christian, that it's like, well, sometimes God does work through our desires. Certainly, like, we love justice, we love beauty, we love truth as Christians. And certainly, even compassion or things like that, there's a number of virtues that Christianity espouses. And these are things that we should strive for. You know, if you know, justice doesn't matter and we should, you know, have no desires for justice, well, who cares? You know, just let everybody do their own thing. And then we get anarchy and chaos. But anyways,
I was going to say there are such things as good desires.
Right. Absolutely.
Worthy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also that there's sometimes that God does tell us, you know, as a Christian, it's like, well, you know, I'm feeling tired. Well, is it legitimate? Like I didn't get enough sleep, or, you know, maybe I did work really hard for, you know, 12 hours or physical labor or things like that. And so my body is telling me like, hey, maybe it's time to get some sleep, instead of saying, okay, I got to deny myself and not have these desires for sleep or whatever. So I actually slowly but surely rejected those human wisdom religions. I actually had my own tarot card deck. I had crystals. I was playing around with that. I was into horoscopes and into biorhythms and all kinds of things. And, you know, that seemed a little arbitrary. And then eventually I got back to monotheism. And I studied with a rabbi. And we read the Old Testament. And he instructed me fairly well. I actually had a very strong sense of the holiness of God. You know, it's one of the major themes of the Old Testament. A number of the books, especially like Leviticus, emphasize God's holiness. And whether it's Isaiah 6 or numerous other passages that God's moral perfection and that he's utterly sinless and that no fellowship can exist between a being of utter, absolute moral perfection and sinlessness and imperfect, finite creatures. And so I actually was struck with a sense of my own sinfulness, my, you know, unworthiness because of that experience. And I was like, okay, this is nice. You know, I'm glad I studied it. Okay, moving on. And then I studied Islam and actually had my own copy of the Quran and read it a lot. And it struck me as like, well, if we actually carried a number of the statutes, like, you know, carry eye to an eye, unfortunately, what we see is like, okay, you know, you knock off my brother. I don't know why. I'm going to go knock off your family or several of your brothers or things like that. And then there were later hadiths that had to address like, okay, you know, can't deal with other followers of the way that way, or the followers of the way of peace that way. And I realized that like a number of the things in Islam were untenable, or, you know, if you follow it through philosophically, you can't do that as a society. You can't do that even as a family. And I cannot, you know, exercise eye for an eye. And that will only perpetuate a cycle of violence and wrongdoing. And so I came back to Christianity, and I had already been somewhat instructed by the Jewish rabbi and others that, you know, the Old Testament ends at, you know, basically Malachi in our canon. And then Matthew is the first book. And of course, as soon as you dive into Matthew and right after the genealogy, You get into within, you know, chapters 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount. And this was mind-blowing to me. It was like, oh, of course, this is correct. This is how you defeat evil. It's, you know, turn the other cheek and not retaliate. And so it actually surprised me. It caught me off guard in contrast to everything that I had studied beforehand. And even, you know, Jesus has a passage about prayer. And so I said, okay, let me try this. Maybe it might work. You know, God, if you are real, I remember praying, you know, please show yourself to me. Please, you know, guide me or help me understand. And I did have the distinct impressions that this was happening and that, you know, my best friend from high school started spending more time with me and, you know, taking me to things, some of his youth group activities, although they weren't terribly overtly Christian, they were more, you know, social. But anyways, my best friend Vern explained to me a number of things at that point in time. So I was much more open and saying, like, I don't understand the Trinity. I don't understand why God has so many names. What is this? And so my friend was very patient and kind of took me through and explained to me what it meant. And slowly but surely, I think I was like, okay, I could see that. That seems reasonable. So he kind of laid that foundation.
So you were at this point, how old were you then? You said later in high school.
So this was, Vern and I started spending a lot of time when I was 16 and 17.
Okay.
So at this point in time.
And you had been, it sounds like, on a very diligent exploration, exploring all mm-hmm. of these different potential faith traditions that didn't mm-hmm. seem to have substance, or at least didn't seem to satisfy your understanding of God or faith or how it relates to reality or the human condition, perhaps. Except when you got to the Old Testament, then it really peered into the human heart. You said you felt the holiness of God, which
yes.
That can be very daunting. But mm-hmm. I love what you talked about when you started reading the New Testament and you started with the stories of Jesus, the gospel narratives, and that there was something mm-hmm. palpably different in mm-hmm. the sense that he seemed to, there was something there a little bit different than what you had felt or experienced before. Now, I'm thinking about this. You had moved from atheism to agnosticism, but with an openness and a willingness to see these different faith traditions or religions for what they were. You were willing to actually take them on to try them mm-hmm. experientially, which, again, I think is very laudable. In your search, rather than just, you know, looking at things intellectually, you actually tried them out experientially. I'm curious when you started reading the New Testament, and you obviously, as an inquisitive person, you started critically thinking, and you had these big questions. And Vern was there, and he was helping guide you. Was he a good resource, or was he, let me just say, more than a nominal Christian? Was he able to engage with you in a way that was intellectually satisfying, able to answer your questions? And also, was he someone who actually embodied Christianity in a meaningful way, not just nominally, not just, you know, by name only, but actually took it seriously?
Yeah, I mean, Vern has always been rock solid in his faith, and he's very much self-identified not only as a Christian, but been very serious about his Christian faith. And at that point in time, even when we were both 16 and 17, he had certainly internalized his family's faith, but also had explored it and was able to articulate why he believed what he believed and could explain a number of things in his faith. And I think I don't ever recall that Vern was ever at a loss. Like, he knew his stuff and really knew his faith.
So you felt, you obviously knew that he was a Christian, and you were, you know, because I think sometimes we wonder how we can start meaningfully engaging with those who aren't Christians, but you obviously knew something about him that you were willing to engage with him, ask him questions, and he was approachable, which sounds pretty wonderful. As you were reading the Bible, and it has this miraculous content, as a former naturalist, when you were reading those kinds of things, was that off-putting?
Sure. So that it was actually a long process for me to, come to actually accept the Bible was true. So I think I started exploring Christianity when I was 16, and I would not have ever said like, yeah, I'm definitely a Christian. In fact, I remember distinctly going off to MIT and thinking, okay, when I get my life in order and, you know, when I finish my PhD or something like that, then I might, you know, consider exploring Christianity more seriously, and maybe then I'll think about becoming a Christian and things like that. So it was not even on my radar when I went to MIT.
Okay.
So it was actually about a 3-year journey from 16 to 19, where there were a number of things, and even sort of shockingly, you might find at MIT there were a number of professors who were Christians, including my academic advisor and now like the department head of AeroAstro. That's Daniel Hastings, is a devout Christian. He was my undergraduate advisor, and then there were numerous other ones. And then the little hints here and there, like they talk about Cantorsets or Gödel and his formulation of God and actual infinites and things like that, talking pretty high level, but like I was resonating with this and was going, huh, I never thought of it that way, but you know, in terms of like actual infinites and as a way to prove for God. And there were a number, even like I had a material science professor who jokingly mentioned that like some MIT students being the, you know, whatever, pranksters that they were, they decided like, oh, you know, let's enter a wine contest and, you know, figure out how to synthetically make a wine. And they combined obviously ethanol and various, you know, carbon compounds and things like that. And then they entered a wine contest and the judges were like, oh, this is really, really good. Where did you get the grapes? And they're like, yeah, we can't tell you that, proprietary knowledge or whatever. And they got busted and they got eliminated. But they synthetically created a wine from, you know, water, carbon compounds, and alcohol, ethanol. So, the idea of even Jesus turning water to wine suddenly became far less far-fetched. Mm. And, that obviously somebody who is very advanced in technology could do these things. But obviously the technology didn't exist back then. So it even argues that somebody who was, you know, the creator of the universe or somebody who had mastery over nature and the elements would be far superior in, you know, order of magnitude than any, you know, human being that existed. So even my time at MIT kind of opened me to a Christian worldview.
So it sounds like even though you were kind of trying to venture a little bit away, you know, from thinking about God, you know, that you entered into an environment where actually there were some very high level discussions about that very reality. So did that kind of bring you back around to the thinking more seriously about the potential for God's existence?
Sure. I think I would say that somewhere between when I was 18 or 19, and certainly, you know, whether it was my freshman year sometime or by that summer, I had accepted that, okay, the Christian God exists, even if I'm not a Christian. You know, like I would not self-identify as a Christian at that point in time. I did say the Christian God exists, and certainly my sense of his holiness prior to the end of high school and my own unworthiness kind of alluded to that, or at least gave me some sense of that. And certainly towards the summer of my freshman year, so as a rising sophomore at MIT, my best friend in high school kind of took me to a number of church events that I started realizing, like, oh, the Bible is not just abstract and, you know, full of weird stories and genealogies. It's very practical and applies to my life. And of course, I'm not ready to live it yet. You know, this forgiveness thing, too hard, not going to try. And, you know, the moral codes, nah, not for me. You know, going to be too hard. Nice ideas, certainly, but not ready to follow after the steps of Jesus. So I would not, again, identify myself as a Christian. I was at that point in time, you know, age 18, turning 19, at least recognizing, like, okay, the Christian God exists. I recognize his existence and certainly his presence in my life. And it makes sense of all that I've gone through. And certainly, I recognize the Bible is, factual and credible and certainly practical. So, you know, that's kind of where I was.
I'd like to take a moment to tell you about a special upcoming C.S. Lewis Institute featured interview on a topic that might be interesting to you all. If you use a smartphone or voice assistant like Alexa or Siri, if you've gone through airport security or shopped online, then you have encountered artificial intelligence, or AI. Have you ever stopped to consider exactly what AI is? Have you wondered about the pros, cons, and ethical implications for you as this technology gains greater power and influence in our world? Dr. John Lennox, who is always both brilliant and winsome, answers these and other questions and gives us clear understanding of not only what AI is, but where it is heading towards its more speculative and futuristic versions. He guides us in ways to think about how AI impacts our view of God, humanity, and salvation itself, and how we should respond. You won't want to miss this pre-recorded interview. There is no charge for this event, but you do need to register. Again, this compelling interview with Dr. John Lennox will be aired on Friday, June 10th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can register on the C.S. Lewis Institute website, cslewisinstitute.org/artificial-intelligence. Now back to our story. So you embraced it a bit intellectually. That it was true, propositionally true, or historically true. But you weren't willing or able to, willing, I guess is the right word, to embrace it personally. So then what happened? I mean, how long did you stay in this kind of bit of ambivalent state?
Sophomore year, I was launched into grades. So I kind of threw myself wholeheartedly into my grades and was getting straight A's even at MIT. And you know, even my professors were patting me on the back saying, like, you know, keep it up. You're doing great. Whatever you'll want will be open to you, whether that's, you know, graduate studies or whether that's working for NASA or whatever else. And so it seemed like the world was my oyster. And, you know, I was really working hard too. You know, I was maintaining some extracurriculars. I had successfully auditioned out of, you know, 10 French hornists. I was the only one who selected for MIT Symphony Orchestra. And it was a fabulous experience. And, you know, I was in numerous other extracurriculars. So I was doing everything that I'd ever wanted to do. And yet I felt like it was empty. And so kind of this existential angst here, you know, I had finished up one of, you know, several all-nighters. So sophomore year in aeronautics and astronautics, which is nicknamed rocket science. But and I kind of came into my room and was thinking to myself, like, hey, everything that I've ever wanted has come about. I'm at MIT. I'm doing incredible. I'm doing research. I'm involved with all these extracurriculars. I'm at the top of my game. It's like, if this is the best life now, I'm living it. And it wasn't like a nadir or, you know, I lost everything. It was, you know, I was at the top. And yet it was like, is there all that it is in life? Like, you know, I've accomplished everything that I've ever wanted. And yet, why do I feel like something is missing? And there's something else. And I had packed a Red King James Bible, which I kept on the left side of my dresser. And coming back into my room, I was like thinking through it. And I was like, you know, yeah, I'm pretty sure if I kept this up, I'd be doing fine in life. And then what? Then get married, then get a job, get you know, whatever. And what does this all mean? And I was at a loss for answers. But as I came into my room, my eye fell on my King James and I opened it up, you know, seek first the kingdom and all these things will be given to you as well. You know, seek first his kingdom. And I realized, you know, yeah, I don't know. Chris doesn't know what's right, what's best for Chris. I think I might. And, you know, later as I became a Christian and I started studying, I realized like, yeah, there is a big God-shaped void in my heart. And I've been trying to stuff it full of everything else, of extracurriculars and achievements. And it wasn't satisfying. And it's not like God instantly changes you and you become like the Borg or whatever. You know, it's not like that when you become a Christian. God reorders your life. And, you know, it's not like I had a lobotomy after I became a Christian and was dumb thereafter. You know, I continue to be intellectual and use my intellect to honor God. But at that point in time, you know, it was late October 1991, I was 19 years old. And I think I remember praying like, you know, God, I don't know what's best for my life. I don't even know how this is supposed to go. I know that you know, because you have seen the past, the present, the future. I know how this is supposed to go. I know you know better than I know what I need. And please help me find people who will help me order my life as would please you.
You surrendered. I mean, you finally came to that place where you were willing to do mm-hmm. go his way instead of your own.
Right, exactly.
Right. Wow. And so that you said that was you had kind of reached the pinnacle and it wasn't enough. And then mm-hmm. and then you surrendered. Mm-hmm. And then I'm curious. In terms of your Christian faith walk, have you been able to find that sense of fulfillment or satisfaction or meaning that seemed so elusive for you when you had everything?
So it has not been easy. And sometimes the route is very circuitous. So even though I prayed for God to put people in my life who would teach me the Bible or teach me his way, I got involved with a deviant group, the Boston Church of Christ, at that point in time. In fact, one of my friends in MIT Symphony Orchestra had just joined the Boston Church of Christ, the Extended International Churches of Christ. And he had been seeking out people that he was going to try to bring in. And so because we were pretty good friends, he decided to invite me, and I got involved with the Boston Church of Christ. And that was a little bit over 2.25 years of that. And kind of long story short, it took a amount of time of searching after that before I came back to Christianity again. So, you know, certainly a lot of looking for the truth and trying to understand what is the truth. And then I came back to Christianity. And then in trying to, you know, align my life with God, I did eventually, like, you know, make a lot of sense of my difficulties, my suffering, my circuitous route in life and things like that. So it hasn't been easy. It hasn't been like going from, you know, mountain to mountain to mountain to mountain. It's been very circuitous.
And for those who aren't familiar, just in a nutshell, the Boston Church of Christ is not a what you would consider to be an Orthodox Christian group. I presume from your work with cults that you would consider this group to be cult-like or a cult. Is that right? Or
sure. So there's a number of synonyms, because like the word cult can certainly bring out a lot of strong emotions. So I try to avoid the word cult sometimes. Certainly we can talk about like either authoritarian groups or totalitarian groups, things that, you know, groups that tell you how to run your life, or that bring out unhealthy psychological dynamics. Certainly. Yes, absolutely. Or we could talk about, you know, spiritually abusive groups, or, you know, groups that cause codependency, especially on, say, like leaders or other members. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, trying to use synonyms for the word cult. Yes, it is not an orthodox group. It's not terribly healthy. But in a nutshell, yes.
But you found your way out of that group and found, I guess, a more healthy, normative kind of Christian church, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, so that again is circuitous. So yeah. I, you know, in a nutshell, I went from my friends who are, that I consider Christians outside of the Boston Church of Christ were shocked when I started hanging out with them. And they were like, "Hey, Chris, did you know you're hanging out with the members of the Boston Church of Christ?" And it's like, yes, I did. And then they're like, "You know, there's all this controversy, and let us give you like, you know, five pages or, you know, or numerous pages and, you know, numerous articles about how controversial they are." And it's like, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into? And then I made the mistake of, you know, again, playing the scientific principles. It's like, okay, I won't tell them I'm looking for something. And if I don't see it, it must not happen anymore. But that was the wrong leap of logic. Mm-hmm. It was, if it doesn't happen, it probably is that they're not telling me, much like in corporations, it's, you know, on a need to know basis rather than total transparency. And so I was very committed to the Boston Church of Christ for a number of years, and then even became a leader, and was actually for being having some integrity. Like I really believed that there were Christians outside of our group, unlike the Boston Church of Christ, that I tried to present a reconciliation meeting, and that failed horribly, but it got back that I was orchestrating it. And then I dared to question that there are issues, like things that could be improved in the Boston Church of Christ. So I was kicked out. And I can honestly say, like, that was God acting, because I would not have had the strength to leave, and I would not have chosen to leave on my own. And, you know, the people have since, you know, numerous of my friends who have left have apologized and said, no, nothing to apologize for. You know, we were kind of under that mindset and being unduly influenced. I had to unwind a lot of that stuff and figure out, okay, what does Christianity actually teach, and, you know, what is actually correct? And it was examining my faith. And kind of that led me to studying the scriptures even more intensely and in the original languages, and studying, you know, church history and theology and things like that. Kind of a weird coincidence, when I was involved with the Boston Church of Christ, one of the deans of administration at MIT had kind of taken me aside and said, like, you know, I know you're involved with the Boston Church of Christ. You really should take some time and study, maybe at a theological institute, study your history, your church history, study your original languages, study your theology. And at that time, when I was a member, I scoffed at him. Oh, all I need is the Bible. And I'd done poorly, you know, my grades had kind of plummeted when I was involved with the Boston Church of Christ, and I had to take some time off. And then eventually that was kind of a further purification process too. It was like I had to, you know, get rid of everything, that all preconceptions of who I was. So I'd kind of wound myself up to be like, okay, I'm this really smart guy who was an MIT student. And suddenly I was stripped of all that. I had to take some time off, no chance of returning. And or at least a year. And then I had to work, claw my way back to finish. And then eventually did finish. And all these experiences had kind of led me to a point where I was like, I'd really like to study my faith better, not only for myself, but also to teach it well. And that led me to seminary. Mm-hmm. And I actually asked that dean for his recommendation letter. And as well, I got involved with a much healthier church, and there were a lot of people who were refugees from the Boston Church of Christ there.
You have a heart, obviously, for those who get wrapped up in things like that. I'd mm-hmm. like to ask you a question as someone who is such a thinker and with an appreciation for philosophy and science and theology. There's often a pushback against Christianity that if you believe in science, that you cannot believe in God or religion or have faith. How would you answer a skeptic or someone who raises that objection that you cannot believe in one or you can't believe in them both together?
Sure. No, absolutely. That's a great question. I was fortunate that I got to meet Alvin Plantinga when he was at Harvard, and he exactly lectured on this. And the way he put it is this, that, like, you know, there seems to be very superficial concord between scientism, which is really what it is. It's not just science, but it's scientism. It's a purely science and naturalistic point of view. But there's actually some deeper discord in the ways that they actually conflict. So it's almost like you have to outright object or get rid of any of the supernatural. You have to ignore a lot of things. And so while there is very superficial concordance between scientism and, say, like atheism or humanism, but also like to truth, that there's much deeper concordance between Christianity and science. And not surprisingly, there are a number of Christians at MIT who were strong Christians, but also strong engineers or strong scientists, and they didn't see a conflict.
Yeah, there's a basic order and rationality to the universe itself with math and mm-hmm. the elegance of mathematics and the way that you're mm-hmm. able to even pursue observation and evidence, and that there's a predictability to it, and all of those things that there would not be unless there was a transcendent source, even your own rationality, right?
Right.
there's a comprehensibility to the universe, and we have a mind that can comprehend. Mm-hmm. So there's just so many things with regard to actually belief in God that allows you, like you say, to even understand the physical nature of the universe. So it's and science. It's really quite wonderful and elegant when you look at it. And there are those, like you say, that have brilliant minds that can see all of that and that there's no mm-hmm. conflict. Mm-hmm. So as we're wrapping up, Chris, let's kind of turn for a moment. If you had a skeptic sitting in front of you or who was actually curious, maybe think back to when you were in high school and you were actually looking, there has to be something more. I feel it, or I intuit, or I have an experience, you know, like you did that there. Okay. There's something, there's something more and I want to search for it. You know, there's an open willingness there. What would you say to that skeptic? How would you speak to them?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, how Christianity is lived out and how it is practiced is going to be a little to quite flawed. Go to the source and look at what Christianity actually is, mm-hmm. and that you know, go to the author of Christianity, Jesus Christ Himself, who I believe is the only perfect person who ever lived, and see the difference, the qualitative difference of his teachings as compared to Buddha or Muhammad or numerous other teachers. And also see, be open to Christianity and kind of look beyond, you know, even if you look at my life, I'm sorry, I'm horrible signpost. I'm you know, a flawed person. And I will be the first to admit that, yes, this means I'm a sinner and I don't live up to the ideals which I'd like to espouse, but look to those ideals, look to the ideals of Christianity and see whether they're true. And not only that Christianity is not just head knowledge, but it's also about a relationship and how would I approach a relationship, right? And I'd want to talk to that person and get to know that person and, you know, maybe figure things out. And as I hinted at, you know, some of my early turnings, it was about prayer. And I had to turn to God and say, like, hey, you know, I really don't know if you're real. I kind of feel silly sometimes, but, you know, show me, please, you know, guide me. And even with all hesitancy that you might have, like, you might not know he's certain that he is there or whatever, but try and try talking to him and try getting to know him, this God that we profess.
That's wonderful. I think as I'm reflecting on your story too, as you're talking and prior to accepting Christ, you felt this great weight of sin. And mm-hmm. And the holiness of God, but yet you said right there that Jesus was the only perfect person who could ever live, and he lifts that burden from you, right? He lifts and forgives your sin so that you don't have to bear that burden anymore. And I think that's really beautiful part of Christianity. If you turned for a moment then to talk with Christians who may know someone or are engaged with those who don't believe, how would you best advise them to engage like Vern did with you?
Sure. I actually still have a number of friends who are atheists and not Christians. And to this day, one of my best friends from MIT is an atheist. And I think he admires that I'm truthful and I'll be happy to point out the flaws. And there's times where he's like, hey, Chris, you know, his name's Matt. He has a PhD from Cornell in statistics now, and he's kind of more fascinated about Christianity from an intellectual point of view. But Matt will say, like, hey, Chris, you know, I'd like to watch Jesus Camp with you sometime and get your insights. And you know, sometimes I've used interesting analogies. It's like, well, you know, there's definitely some people in the church that I'm like, okay, you know, crazy Uncle Bob who just wants to talk about fishing all the time, or, you know, Aunt Emma who just, you know, is like 57 cats and she's the crazy cat aunt and whatever else. Yeah, there's some of that in our background, and I'm sorry, you know, they're part of the family still too. And yeah, I got to accept them, and it is what it is, but hopefully there are some more sane parts of the family that you can kind of identify with and get along with. So there's definitely times where I haven't tried to like hide all of our warts and pimples and things like that. It's like, well, you know, I've got crazy parts of my family and also in the extended family. And that's also true in Christ, and it's okay. We're imperfect, but you know, we are part of the same family, and yeah, you know, maybe I would really like them not to be, but they are. And, you know, also having an open dialogue with them. So Matt knows that he can talk to me about anything, and we have actually a pretty interesting relationship. Like, we'll talk about the new atheists, and he'll have read them, and I'll have read them, and we'll compare notes. And although Matt is an atheist, he's never been like, you know, Chris, you're crazy for believing what you believe. He's respected it. And even with my work with cults, he'll see like, okay, so you're basically a specialist and you deal with like all of those weird parts of the family that people don't want to, you know, really acknowledge exist. So yeah, good for you. Good on you.
So he respects you. And yes. What I love about what you're saying here is that you keep an open dialogue. You speak with him intellectually on his terms, you read things together, mm-hmm. you discuss them, you have a nice open dialogue. It's not defensive, it's inquisitive, you learn from each other. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that you have ongoing relationships because I think that's tremendous. I think that's huge. Wow, what a story. Chris, amazing story, amazing life, and an amazing intellect too. And I think that bodes well for really demonstrating, your whole story demonstrates this real strong intellectual pursuit of truth and what's real and that you have come to the place not only believing it intellectually, but giving your life to the one who exists, who's real, who lived the perfect life. And so he's obviously transformed you and giving you loads of meaning and purpose in your life. So I just really appreciate you coming on board today to talk to us about your story.
Thank you for your time.
Very good. Thanks for tuning into Side B Stories to hear Chris's story. You can find out more about his ministry, Exposing Cults, by visiting his website, which I'll put a link in the episode notes. For questions and feedback about this episode, you can contact me through our new website, sidebstories.com. If you enjoyed it, follow, rate, review, and share this podcast with your friends and social network. We would also love it if you would take a moment to write a review. In the meantime, I'll be looking forward to seeing you next time, where we'll see how another skeptic flips the record of their life.